Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Having reached the appointed time for the committee to start, we're going to get going. I believe we may be close to a quorum here. We are.
Oh, there we go.
Excellent. So we can officially call this meeting to order. Thank you for being with us today. We have some minutes to take care of. We have minutes first from the April 16th meeting, April 16th, 2015. Representative Atkins, I'm sure, remembers every detail of that meeting and has thoroughly reviewed the minutes. Do you move for their approval?
On behalf of the Purple Caucus over here, literally. Be happy to move.
Thank you. Atkins moves the approval of the minutes of April 16th, 2015. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Thank you. Then we have another set of minutes from March 3rd of 2016. I believe that Representative Runbeck has reviewed these. Do you move their approval?
So move, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And opposed by the same sign. Approved. Thank you, members. We have a new page with us. There he is, Matthew Spellman. Matthew, please introduce yourself and tell us, go to a microphone, please.
Okay.
Introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name is Matthew Spellman. I'm finishing my final semester at the University of Minnesota in political science and philosophy. I live in Northeast and I'm very excited to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Matthew. Welcome aboard. We look forward to working with you. So is there like a conflict with those two, that double major you've got?
Definitely.
Uh-huh. Okay. I've never taken a course in either one, so. But I'm sure you will bring vast knowledge to our committee. We have a couple of things on the agenda this afternoon. We're going to start with the Metropolitan Council. Please introduce yourselves for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetton. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. We appreciate the opportunity to be before the committee to talk about our 2016 bonding requests. We have two of them that we'd like to talk to you about. The first deals with the $10 million bonding request for the Metropolitan Regional Park System, and we have an additional $5 million request for inflow and infiltration mitigation grant programs. And I have some staff here that will quickly go through a little bit more specificity on those, but I just want to make sure that the committee is aware that 100% of these bond dollars that we're requesting all go directly to local communities. It does not go to the council. It is pass-through money that makes its way back into the implementing agencies, and then on the INI piece, it goes directly to communities. So with that, I have Emmett Mullen, and I'd like to introduce Emmett. Emmett, for many of you who've served on bonding in previous years, Arnie Steffarud has been our parks director who has been working with us, and Arnie retired after last session. So Emmett is our new parks director, regional parks director for the Metropolitan Council, and he's going to give you a very brief overview of our park system and our bonding request.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present to you and ask for your support of our $10 million request for Metropolitan Regional Parks. My name is Emmett Mullen, and I'm the manager of the Regional Parks and Natural Resources Unit at Metropolitan Council. As you all know, our amazing Metropolitan Regional Parks and Trails system serves people from all over the region and the state, and it really helps define our outdoor culture here in Minnesota. The Metropolitan Regional Park System was created in 1974 by an act of the legislature. This act also created the Metropolitan Parks and Open Space Commission, and that began analyzing the needs of the regional system. And this act authorized the Metropolitan Council to identify land which, together with state parks and trails, will meet the needs of the region. So the council's role in regional parks is to conduct high-level long-range planning, as well as coordinate funding for the system. And the second reason is why I'm here today. So what is the Metropolitan Regional System? Well, first of all, the Metropolitan Council doesn't own or operate any parks or trails. That's done by the 10 regional park implementing agencies. That includes the counties of Anoka, Ramsey, Washington, Dakota, Scott, and Carver. Additionally, the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, the cities of St. Paul and Bloomington, and then Three Rivers Park District, which runs parks predominantly in Hennepin County. The system has 54 regional parks and park reserves and 8 special features, special recreation features, and more than 340 miles of regional trails, all encompassed in an area of over 54,000 acres. So it's a big system. What defines the regional system? Generally, it's made up of parks of large acreage. They're nature-based parks, so natural resource-based, I guess is a better way to say it. And at least 45% of the visitors to the park or trail come from areas outside of the local jurisdiction. So that's hence the regional name. The next slide is the breakdown, and it's hopefully readable, of how the $10 million will be distributed to the 10 regional park implementing agencies. These numbers include both the $10 million in state bonds and the $6.67 million in Metropolitan Council bonds that are leveraged. Another way to put this is that for every $3 in state bonds, there's an additional $2 in Met Council bonds. And I just wanted to also say that it will also leverage local and federal money of over $2.5 million. So it's almost a one-to-one match. The next slide is about what Judd said. 100% of the $10 million goes directly to the implementing agencies, distributed through a funding formula. And the funding formula goes like the pie says. 70% is based on population of the jurisdiction, and 30% is based on the jurisdiction's share of non-local visits. This is my last slide, and this is just a map of the prioritized projects spread out across the region. In your packet of information is a detailed list of all these proposed projects that will be implemented under this funding level. These projects have been prioritized by the implementing agencies, so they've all been vetted, and they're targeting the highest priority needs. So as you know, the system has grown over the years through significant public investments. Now we need to protect and sustain this investment to ensure that these well-loved assets are available today and into the future. Thank you for considering this request, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you. I have a question for you. Mr. Mullet, was it?
Yes.
What do you know?
Emmett Mullen.
Are there user fees involved with any of these facilities?
I think, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the answer to that question is no, except I think Washington County and Carver County do have a gate fee. Otherwise, maybe Anoka County too. I will find out that information, Mr. Chair, and send it to you. But
thank you. Yeah. Very good. Representative Hausman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What you initially requested 11, and there was 10 in the governor's bill. Do you know what dropped off when you went from 11 to 10?
I do know that. Representative Hausman, but I don't have that information with me today, so I could send that to you. When the bill went from $11 million to $10 million, we asked the agencies to reprioritize, and so we'll get that information to you.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I could, so on this one slide, 48 million annual visits encompasses the entire system, any of the... any of what we're seeing here. 48 million is the total visitors?
Yes, the $48 million annually. So it's just a huge number of people use our regional parks and trail system.
Thank you. Mr. Mullet, could you tell me how you'd identify the 48 million visitors? What's it take to be a visitor?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the visitors are counted, I think that it's an every five-year survey, and it is done through intercept surveys. So as you can guess, in a busy metropolitan area, there is a methodology to capture who's entering and exiting the system, because as you know, a lot of these regional parks and trails don't have gates.
And Mr. Chair and members, we'll be happy to come back with some of the science behind how we're able to do that. We have similar questions on how we count riders on our transit vehicles as well. So I think if we can come back and provide a little bit more detail on that calculation for counting the visitors, we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Representative Atkins has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mullen, thank you for your presentation and welcome.
Thank you.
All right, so you got 9 number one priorities. And kind of in all sincerity, if my hope would be that all of your top priorities across all of the various jurisdictions will get funded as part of the package.
Thank you.
How do you make the decision, though, now you're getting to number two priorities? And I perhaps this is for you, perhaps this is for the council, Mr. Shetton, but is there a process that you go through in terms of how to determine which priority comes before, which number two would come before the next number two, for example?
Mr. Mullen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the projects were prioritized by the implementing agencies, and so they were the ones that determined, based on local needs, what the number one priority is, what the number two priority is, and so forth. So we didn't make that determination. That was something we did in coordination with the implementing agencies.
Representative Atkins, so follow up.
Mr. Chairman, then, so Mr. Bowen, then it's just sort of a UFC or a cage match then? And you put those county commissioners and so forth into a cage and see who comes out as the winner?
Mr. Mullen.
Mr. Chair, committee members, it's part of a funding formula. So the funds are distributed to all 10 implementing agencies based on population and based on non-local visits.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, what this slide depicts is whatever the number that the state will provide in their bonding appropriation, the council is able to match $2 for every $3 that the state puts in. And then what we're able to do is run that through a formula based on this pie chart then that gets distributed to each of the implementing agencies, and then they put together their capital improvement program and rank the priorities that they have. So that's how that is put together. So it's fair in that way that it goes back to the implementing agencies for them to decide.
Got it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Shetton, if you could back up one more slide. So if the pool expands or shrinks, the relative pieces of the pie stay the same size, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, that is correct. It's
thank
just
you.
The dollar amount that changes, but the formula share remains the same.
Very good. Thank you. Seeing no other questions for you, Mr. Mullen, welcome aboard. Nice to have you with us. I'm sure we'll be seeing you again sometime in the
thank
future.
You, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Albright, did you have a question for Mr. Mullen?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mullen, with regard to the $5 million for the infiltration grant program.
We're going to do that next.
We aren't there yet, but I'll put your name at the top of the list, Representative Albright.
Thank you.
As you can infiltrate at the next opportunity.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to introduce Jason Willett. Jason is our Assistant General Manager for our Metropolitan Council Environmental Services Utility, and he is here to speak on our inflow and infiltration request. We've got a $5 million request for that, and I know that Patty Nauman from Metro Cities will be here as well to speak about the impact to the communities and how they support this as well. But with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Willett.
Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. I'm Jason Willett from the Metropolitan Council. I'm Assistant General Manager for the Environmental Services Division. We serve a wholesale service function in the metro area. We have 108 cities directly connected to our system. We have 8 treatment plants. I do want to mention that our user fee funded rates are 40% below the national average, and our environmental performance is award-winning across the country. We have really a good value because of the economy of scale. I'm going to just touch on a high level of the I&I program and then save some of your time, I hope, for questions about any particulars you might have. So the request is $5 million, and we would use this, as we have in past years. You do have a handout, I believe, on this. We would use it to pass through 100% of that money to the cities. In the past, we have set up a program with the city's guidance and passed through up to 50% of the costs that are eligible, that are I&I mitigation related. So that does mean that often it's quite a bit less than 50% because we have quite a bit more demand. But sometimes it's been close, we don't really know until we actually put out the application for that. The eligibility in the past has been for those cities where we've had measured excessive I&I in our system. So we see the rate of flow several times, the dry weather flow, we know that's problematic. And those that are close to that level of excessive I&I. Go ahead. I wanted to show that because sometimes there's a little bit of confusion, there are actually three ways that inflow and infiltration can get into our system. First of all, there are the regional pipes that are shown by the big pipe down below. We have over 600 miles of these big pipes. We call them interceptors. They intercept the flow between cities. So we are able to use our user fees, and we have quite an accelerated program to replace those assets, and I don't believe that's much of a problem. What I wanted to show you in particular here, the yellow pipe depicts a city pipe. There are like 5,000 miles of that around the metropolitan area. Some of them are quite old. And that's really the subject of this bond request, so that we can help the cities. There are also ways that, frankly, that I&I can get in through private connections, which are shown here with a house. And that's a problematic thing. We have a task force, and we're working to find ways to address the private sector issues on that. The only other thing I wanted to do was show you some pictures and just talk quickly about the impact of I&I if, and I guess I should say when, clean water gets to the sewers. We clean it up, but unnecessarily, and then we flush it. So it goes down the Mississippi and it's lost to Minnesota. When there's outflow, which could be a spill, as happened in the western suburbs a couple years ago, it can impair water quality. Beaches can be closed. We've had a number of these actually through the year, although much less. And also there's the possibility of, you know, the pipes leaking into the groundwater without any treatment, so pollution directly into the groundwater. Certainly, when we get this rush of flow that can be 5, 6, 7 times the dry weather flow, sometimes the pipes are too full. We looked at that 10 years ago when we started this program. It looked like $1 billion to build out for this unnecessary, unneeded capacity. And thankfully, this program's been working, so we haven't had to spend that yet. So I think that covers all of the impacts of flow, and maybe I could just try and answer questions about the specifics.
Representative Albright has a question.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the graphic on the bottom of page 6 and very appreciable. I guess a twofold question. The first is, if you take a look at the graph, you know, what percentage of these grants are used for each aspect of that system? And then the second part is, how much of it is planned, and how much what percentage of the grant money is actually utilized in crisis situations that just come up, and how do you react to those on a timely basis?
Mr. Willen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Good questions. 100% of this money would go to the city pipe depicted here in yellow. The regional pipes, we use our user fees to try and fix and avoid. There is an occasional emergency, but, you know, that's all covered with user fees. And the private sector is looking for a source of funding to try and incentivize them to also reduce the chance of that water getting into. So 100% of this for city infrastructure.
Okay.
For your question about emergency, overwhelmingly this is planned proactively. The cities are doing a good job of trying to anticipate and keep the I&I out of the system. There may be an occasional emergency, but of course they fix that regardless of grant funds being available.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair and members, we have brought forward requests in the past regarding looking at general fund or clean water fund monies to be able to offer grants to private homeowners for this. But since these bonds are restricted and used in a public by a public entity, that's why these funds can only be used for the municipalities.
Thank you. Representative Uglem has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, basically, you know, local cities, what are local cities and communities doing right now to minimize the I&I in terms of regulations or rules and things like that? We understand that in certain events of huge water deluges and rain and things, we're going to have this problem, but are there ongoing regulations that cities can use to manage this better?
Mr. Willett.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you for the question. Cities, of course, don't regulate themselves, so this money is talking about, you know, what they would do to proactively manage. Is your question about what they would do about the private sector I&I into the system?
Correct. I mean, obviously, cities can enact ordinances to try to minimize this. What type of ordinances are they doing? Are they managing this adequately?
Mr. Willett.
Mr. Chair, I know a bit about what the cities are doing. Some of them have done point-of-sale inspection repair, but Patty Nauman probably knows a lot more about this than I, so if I may just defer to her.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, Patricia Nauman, Executive Director of Metro Cities, and I just very quickly want to say that we do support funding for inflow and infiltration mitigation assistance to communities in the metropolitan area, and I've worked in previous years to secure these types of appropriations. The issue of addressing the private side of I&I, which these funds would not address, is very complicated, and right now there is a task force that was just recently co-convened by Metro Cities and the Metropolitan Council Environment Services staff to try to get a better handle on some of those issues and whether cities, part of that would be looking at whether cities would be open to any additional, perhaps even state requirements that would, like say point of sale or other types of requirements to try to make sure there's a more consistent, uniform way of addressing those issues. But we haven't gotten to those conclusions. Just starting to talk about those things, but haven't reached any conclusions yet.
Follow-up, Representative Google.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm glad that somebody is working on it and that a task force has been appointed or whatever, so thank you.
Thank you. I have a question from Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The microphone, please, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to answer that last question, Representative Uglem, some cities are regulating. They regulate the home, and the inspectors go in the home and check the equipment. And then if there's a problem and you have to repair it, they assess you a tax, and you have to pay it. And that's where the frustration comes in. There's no best management practice. There's no cost share. There's just you have to do it. And so if Mr. Schnettman comes back up, we've been dealing with this in my district since 08, right?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, members.
The first angry citizen meeting was in 08.
That is correct. We sat in her home and talked to her.
So there's people who have costs. So if you are on a fixed income and you're 85 years old and you're in the house you've been in for 50 years and suddenly you've got the cost and you get an $8,000 assessment, if you don't have the money to bring it up, it'll just be put on your property tax statement. So this is what's happening. Yeah. Now, if we get down, and Mr. Chair, I like the bill that was heard in the previous committee, which asked for $10 million, because the need out there, I think, Representative Albright, is very high throughout the metro in many districts. Yep. So the public sector cost, if that can be reduced, then you're not having the additional private sector cost. If you can take care of the leaky public cost, then that helps out. So maybe Mr. Schnettman could talk about yep. how this ongoing 8 to 10 year experience we've had, that now more and more cities are having to do it as the fines come in on the cities where you have to take care of it.
Yep. Anything to add, Mr. Schnettman?
Yep, and Mr. Chair and members, just to add a little bit more detail, is that when these issues occur at the private service lateral in a private home, where the homeowner actually owns that connection that gets to the city pipe that makes its way to the council interceptor, if there is an issue at that point where that needs to be fixed, the average cost of fixing that is between $5,000 and $7,500. And you're digging up your yard and you're having to go in and completely replace that. And so we are very happy and thankful that the legislature has provided money in the past for us to work with Ms. Nauman and her cities, and Representative Nelson has helped us with these bills in the past, but there is a broader issue than just what we're able to do here with the municipalities, and so there is a very expensive cost at the private side of this if there is found to be an INI problem at that homeowner's service lateral, which is the blue pipe there that you can see, that skinny pipe that runs to the yellow city pipe.
Thank you, Mr. Shetland. We have time for just a couple more questions. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just we've been hearing a lot about this because we are hearing a proposal from the Metropolitan Council today, but my hunch is that this is not exclusive to the seven county metro area. And just a quick question, since you're here to, from the Met Council, are you aware of any funding that is available, has been available, or might be available for Greater Minnesota, because they're certainly experiencing the same kinds of issues, but we're hearing a proposal from the Met Council just so that we can treat all of Minnesota who has the same common problem with a common solution, perhaps.
Mr. Willett, do you have any comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you again. Good, it's an excellent question. And the first thing that I want to say, it'd be great if there's this kind of money. Lots of money would be needed. Everywhere there's old infrastructure in the state, there's II issues. It is a priority in the metro area because of the density of people, the health and environmental impacts, the cost of building unnecessary capacity. And other parts of the state may not see it as quite the priority. These projects, to some degree, are eligible for loans from the Public Facilities Authority, regardless of where they are in the state. But that's loans, not grants.
President McGinnis, you have the last question, and we have to move on.
Just understanding the source of the problem, someone has asked me if it's some of the things that we dispose of exacerbating the problem, from the microbeads, the wipes, what else that might be toxic that's going down the drains. Can you help us out there?
Mr. Willard, briefly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morginius, thank you. You point out lots of other issues related to water quality in the operations, and those are things, particularly the flushable thing that you'll hear about during this session. Those are an issue for us too. Microbeads and the emerging contaminants are water quality issues, but this is about clear water, clean water that gets into our system and mixes with the sewage. Then if it gets out, you know, it's untreated sewage, so that's sort of the environmental and public health issue.
But it's so that's just inflow though.
Right, and infiltration. And outflow, so if there's a spill. You might remember one in Mound in Lake Minnetonka a couple years ago. There have been a number of these throughout the year, or particularly from the household service laterals. Some of them were clay tile 60 years ago. They're degraded. That sewage then sinks into the groundwater without treatment. Okay. So that's
I
sewage.
I think, Mr. Chair, he's not getting quite to my question.
Very quickly, Representative.
Are the things that are coming through the line scouring or doing anything to exacerbate the breakdown of the pipes?
Madam Chair, Representative Wiggins, it's not that I'm aware of. Sometimes hydrogen sulfide from this could exacerbate the pipes wearing out, so maybe yes, because of that.
We should understand that.
Perhaps I can have a technical person get back to you on that.
That would be very good. Thank you, Mr. Willett. Thank you, all of you, for your presentation today. We're going to move on now to the Department of Agriculture. Uh, Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I am Jim Borbom, Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I'm here just to cover a brief overview of the bonding request for the Minnesota Rural Finance Authority. And in your packet, you should have a one-page fact sheet titled Rural Finance Authority, and I will just be referencing that in my comments. The governor's proposal has a request or an authorization to sell general obligation bonds in the amount of $35 million. The proceeds from the bond sales would be used to support loan programs administered by the Minnesota Rural Finance Authority. This loan program has been in existence in the state of Minnesota since 1986. And rather than making loans directly to farmers, the Rural Finance Authority partners with more than 400 community banks and members of the farm credit system to extend credit to our farm families. Farmers borrowing loans through this program pay a lower interest rate than they would normally pay, and the public-private partnership improves a farmer's cash flow and provides greater access to credit because the lenders are willing to make the loans. Since the loan that they make, they share the risk with the RFA. The Rural Finance Authority is governed by an 11-member board. The board consists of four agency commissioners, that being Agriculture, Commerce, Employment and Economic Development, Minnesota Management and Budget, and the State Auditor. The other six members are public members appointed by the governor. The chair of the board, I should say, is the Commissioner of Agriculture. One unique thing about this program is that the bonds for the program are user financed. They are authorized under Article 11, Section 5, Clause H of the Minnesota Constitution. And the purpose of the bonds, again, is to purchase a participation interest in a real estate loan. They are only can be authorized for real estate purposes. And the way the program works is a lender would originate a real estate loan, sell 45% of that loan amount up to a certain dollar amount to the Minnesota Rural Finance Authority, retain the balance of the loan in their portfolio, and again, the Rural Finance Authority can offer a fixed rate of interest for a 10-year term, and in some cases up to a 20-year term. So the advantage of the program is a reduced interest rate to the farm families, and then also shared credit risk on behalf of the lender. This program has a very strong record of success. There are more than nearly about 2,900 loans that have been issued under the program for $215 million. We've been very pleased with the level of loan losses. I'm quite surprised that over the course of those 30 years, we've had just over $500,000 in loan losses, and that represents about 20 loans. We currently carry a current loan balance of about $50 million. The annual loan activity in any given year can vary from about $10 million up to $16 million. The loan activity is very sensitive to interest rates and also to land prices, those types of events. And just I'll close again on how the program works. Once the bond sales are authorized, we use the proceeds from the bond to buy the loan participations. The principal and interest receipt on those loan participations then are deposited into a dedicated account. Minnesota Management and Budget annually sweeps the money out of that dedicated account every December, and those funds then are used to pay the debt service on the bond. So that's the unique thing about the program. It is user financed. We don't sell $35 million in one shot. We look at the level of loan demand and the timing when Minnesota Management and Budget authorizes sales, and will size the loan, or I should say the bond sale, according to the amount of loan demand. And Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to, again, I know that many members here that are familiar with this program and have supported it over the years, so again, would appreciate your support.
Thank you, Mr. Borbom. Any questions regarding RFA today? Looks like you've done a fantastic job of meeting all our needs for information, and thank you for your presentation. Mr. Woolman, would you want to add anything to this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have a second request.
Oh, you have a second? I should look at my agenda.
Department of Agriculture's laboratory.
All right. Well, if we're done with the RFA, and I believe we are, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Matt Wallman. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and I'm here to discuss the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's laboratory capital equipment request, which was included in the governor's bonding proposal for $2.218 million. The Department of Agriculture has a world-class laboratory. The facility, which was built in 2005, houses both the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health laboratories. Upon construction, this lab was equipped with to effectively respond to emergencies and perform required surveillance to protect all Minnesotans. The laboratory is a critical resource for the department. It's the core foundation of our work. Without reliable scientific data, we're not able to make good decisions about important issues such as food safety, health and well-being of Minnesota's rivers, lakes, and streams, or to respond to critical emergencies that could threaten our economy. In 2009, this laboratory, in partnership with the Department of Health and the University of Minnesota and folks within our Dairy and Food Inspection Division, were able to isolate, identify, and trace back the cause of the Peanut Corporation of America outbreak, which inflicted salmonella illness on about 714 confirmed cases in 46 states across the country, including 44 cases right here in Minnesota. The same outbreak claimed the lives of nine people across the country. There are countless other cases like this where the department has undertaken critical work to protect public health, the environment, and maintain the public's trust. However, capital equipment costs required to meet the changing and emergency needs of the department go beyond the levels that can be supported within the regular operating budgets. The nature of laboratory work has evolved over the past decade and requires more sophisticated laboratory equipment to meet program goals and objectives. Some of these pieces of equipment in our laboratory can cost upwards of $500,000. Budgetary pressures have resulted in some limited investments for maintenance and replacement of laboratory capital equipment, making it increasingly difficult to sustain assets in a condition necessary to reach expected service levels. Deferring maintenance and asset replacement jeopardizes the department's ability to provide services that could threaten public health and safety. Additionally, deferring maintenance or replacement will increase the long-term operating costs of the department and liabilities of the department should these systems fail. The laboratory is currently working with equipment that's past its life expectancy, and the planned investment in current technology is crucial in meeting our goals for customer service and quality. Laboratory performance is measured in part by our ability to respond to issues as they emerge, and having reliable equipment is critical to effectively and timely respond in all of these program areas. As equipment ages and repair costs increase, more of our program budgets become unavailable for program functions, and it negatively affects the performance indicators such as turnaround time, which results in decreased capacity for analysis. Now, make no mistake about it, we do have a world-class lab. We are still producing very strong and reliable results. However, if we're going to maintain this level of laboratory analysis, we need to make an investment. And while we have been repairing and replacing equipment to meet the high levels of service, the simple reality is the laboratory equipment continues to reach its expected life faster than we are replacing it. So the governor's $2.218 million request for laboratory capital equipment would replace the capital equipment, laboratory equipment, that is near or beyond its life expectancy. And in addition to this request, we are also exploring an ongoing laboratory equipment replacement account separate to this that would provide the resources necessary to repair and replace this equipment on an ongoing basis. This would be similar to how a business or a farmer would depreciate their assets over time and be putting that money aside to replace those assets. So in conclusion, this request is vital to ensuring that we can maintain a strong laboratory for the Department of Agriculture. And I thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to join you today.
Thank you, Mr. Wolman. Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe this is a question for Ms. Dyson. So Mr. Wolman mentioned that, you know, we built a world-class facility in 05, and we're in 2016. So if we have a 10-year lifespan on equipment, how can we bond for that if we need to have a 30-year lifespan? I mean, isn't this a problem with the general obligation bonds? So if we, so this is cash?
Yes.
So cash, if the general taxpayers are paying for this, I think there are, Mr. Wolman, what type of analysis are done on these mass spectrometers?
Mr. Wolman.
Mr. Chair, Michelle Campbell is here. She's our section manager for chemistry in the department. She may be able to answer that. I'm not.
Please introduce yourself for the record and try to answer
the question.
I'm
Michelle Campbell. I'm the chemistry section manager at the MDA laboratory. Committee members, Mr. Chair, the analysis that we do using the variety of equipment includes the LC-MS-MS primarily for pesticide residue analysis of both for water quality and food safety.
Representative Hansen.
I think we've put about $10 million a year into the clean water funds into the agency, and I think there are user fees that have been assessed on whether it's rural or urban pesticide users and fertilizer users. So my question is, why are we coming to the general fund then to pay for these things if we have a user financing method where I believe you probably have some funds that could pay for it?
Mr. Wolman.
Mr. Chair, those funds are dedicated accounts. They're fees that are charged to users or farmers for a very specific purpose. And so the statutory obligation of the department is to spend those monies where and for the purpose in which they are collected. This laboratory covers a wide variety of issues, from food safety to public health to a number of other different areas. And so I guess we see this as a priority that's beyond a specific program or account.
Follow up, Representative Hansen.
So just to be clear, it's not just farmers that pay that, it's urban folks as well. And those, I think under your authority, to protect groundwater, you have to do the groundwater sampling and the surface water sampling. So I maybe this is a question, Mr. Chair, if we could see the total amount of money that's been paid for on these products for clean water fund, general fund, bonding dollars, just to have some comparison of who's paying for these type of programs. Because I'm a little concerned if we've got a 10-year lifespan, and I understand I understand how equipment and technology changes. I think it's a good idea if you set up an account. I think I'd feel more comfortable if that account was funded with actual user fees rather than the general taxpayers.
I did not hear a question in that. Any comments, Mr. Wolman? Otherwise, we'll go on another question.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to work with you and Representative Hansen to get you the information you need to consider the request.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Wolman. I think I have a little easier question for you, maybe. I'd like to ask about a project that's not technically part of the Department of Agriculture's budget and bonding plan, but I think that the Department of Agriculture supports it. What I'd like to ask about is a provision that was in the governor's bonding proposal last year and not on the list this year. And in case I'm building suspense here, if you there is a $5 million request for backup power for the city of Litchfield to clear the way for First District, Minnesota's largest cheese producer and a family or farmer-owned cooperative, to have the infrastructure that it needs to move forward on a $125 million expansion. Mr. Wilmer, can you confirm that the Department of Agriculture is supportive of this for this project and that it has statewide impact?
We're a bit far afield, but very quickly, Mr. Wilmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berdahl, as you know, the dairy industry in Minnesota is a significant economic driver that supports about 40,000 jobs and $12 billion in economic activity. And in fact, we know that the multiplier effect of one cow is about $25,000 in economic activity. First District, which is headquartered in your district, is one of the major dairy processors in Minnesota, receives milk from about 47 counties, I believe, across the state. I know that they are planning a $125 million expansion, and I know that one of the major obstacles of that expansion is the fact that they don't have backup power, which is critical to making sure that we don't get into a situation where we have perishable product perishing in the event of a power failure. The department strongly supports the expansion for First District. The economic activity and the impacts to the dairy industry and to Minnesota farmers would be significant. And so we support, Mr. Chairman, moving this project. There are strong consideration for this project.
Thank you, Mr. Wong. Representative Uglum has a question.
Yes, just quickly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I used to be involved in a little bit of this laboratory equipment stuff. Are you able to, with, for instance, the mass spec or whatever, are you able to trade that in? I remember that Gardner Scientific and other people like that had programs where you could save some money and trade it in. And then secondly, what is the difference? Mass spec is a mass spec. Have there been that many advances? I mean, you're still dealing with the same way that the machinery operates. Is it just more accurate right now, or what? They don't really wear out.
Mr. Wallman, a brief answer, then we'll move on.
Representative, Mr. Chair, yes, after the technology does age, and in fact the technology is rapidly advancing, often the vendors no longer support the instruments with replacement parts and supplies. So,
Mr. Chair, so that's really the main part. You're not being supported by the vendor anymore.
Correct, yes.
Okay.
And get the parts to repair them.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. Thanks for being with us today. Next up, we have the State Academy. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bob Stepanek. I'm a retired Minnesota school superintendent. I'm currently serving as the interim superintendent at the Minnesota State Academies for the Deaf and the Blind in Faribault. I'm here today, of course, to talk to you about the bonding requests that have come forward. And as Matt passes out some information, I'll be referring to some things in the folders. I assume you're all familiar with the State Academies, being that it's a state agency. You should know that we serve 160 kids in a residential setting in Faribault, and that it has been a state agency since 1858. So there's a long and rich history there. When I came on board in December, the proposal for
bonding projects had already been submitted to the governor's office. You will see in the project narrative within the folder that there were some 18 projects that were suggested for a total of $8 million. Most of those projects were related to maintenance of the buildings at the academies, and I need not go through the details there. You can see them as you look at the project. However, three of the projects were supported in the governor's budget, and I'd like to give some attention to those projects. The total for that the governor supports is about is a little over $2 million. $2 million $2 million will go for one project, the re-roofing of Noyes Hall, which is one of two buildings at the Academy's campus that is on the state register. The other projects include a proposal for a track to be built at the Academy's. The amount requested, $160,000, is about a third of the cost. We have commitments from the Minnesota Blind Foundation for about $150,000. And then assuming that the legislature approves the $160,000, we're looking to apply to the Ray Charles Foundation in California, which has indicated they would be interested in contributing as well. The third project is a feasibility study to build a walkway to connect three buildings, and this is a security concern. Our children in attending classes end up going between, or amongst, I should say, three buildings, and there's about a 200-foot opening that has been suggested can be enclosed and then can also better secure our buildings. And so it's basically comes from the thought that security could be enhanced if we could build that. That $2.2 million, as I said, has made it through the governor's office, and I can entertain any questions that you may have about those projects at this time.
Thank you. Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know we visited the state academies a number of times, and I'm just trying to look at what we've, I know Representative Fritz had us down there a lot, and there were some major, maybe Ms. Dyson or Representative Hausman, we've put quite a bit of money in recently and into the state academies, correct? Or
Mr. Stepanek?
Yes, we just completed a $2 million technology upgrade that was a couple years, was approved by the legislature a couple years ago. And then we're in the final stages of planning for a new dorm. We're tearing down an old dorm. I believe that's about a $10 million project that we expect to get the shovel in the ground probably in June. So yes, there has been money for upgrades. I think the concern that is difficult for everyone is the fact that the buildings on the campus are older and need more attention. And the deferred maintenance that we have identified is closer to $50 million. Now, obviously, we're not going to request or even expect to get $50 million. But if we have emergencies, we will be at the state store to try and get boilers fixed and things like that. But we do thank you for the support for those projects.
Representative Hausman has a point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps you just misspoke, but you referenced we have a pre-designed study of the security corridor, and you used the term feasibility study. That would be something different.
Okay, you're right.
And
should
not
be pre-designed study.
So, I mean, you know already it's a feasible project, and you are going to pre-design.
I don't know that, but that's what we're trying to flesh out and by getting experts in to do the study.
So, I mean, just to clarify, so feasibility study wouldn't be bondable, but pre-design would. So just to clarify language.
Thank you.
So that we know.
We will make sure that gets straightened out.
Okay.
I don't see any other questions from members. Mr. Stepanek, is that
yes.
Right? Am I pronouncing that
yes,
correctly?
Yes, you are.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Next up is the Department of Health.
Good
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Paul Allwood. I'm Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Department of Health. And with me is Abigail Mosher, our Chief Financial Officer. Thanks to you, Mr. Chair, and all the members for the opportunity to speak about the Minnesota Department of Health's capital investment request. MDH is requesting $2.335 million from the general fund to replace our aging lab instruments and purchase equipment with the updated technology necessary to protect the health and well-being of all Minnesotans, from newborns to seniors. We've provided a fact sheet that summarizes the request, the reasons for the request. However, they're primarily that demands for testing by the MDH Public Health Lab have become more frequent and more complex. Key lab equipment have passed the end of their useful service life, and there is no dedicated funding mechanism to purchase new capital equipment for the laboratory. Most Minnesotans rarely hear about the nation-leading work of our public health lab, yet this highly capable facility is essential in the near-constant fight against infectious disease threats. The lab also provides early detection of disorders in newborns, and also identifies emerging environmental contaminants. The lab's work touches the lives of virtually everyone in the state in some way. The lab monitors and detects a wide range of health threats, such as the rabies and Zika viruses, radiological contamination, heritable and congenital disorders in newborns, and suspected terrorism designed to cause mass casualties. This work requires sophisticated instrumentation and highly trained scientists, as well as the commitment to provide services that may be unavailable elsewhere, but which are essential for the public good. Advancements in communication, trade, and travel have shrunk the world, but have also vastly expanded the number of challenges that our lab must be prepared to deal with, sometimes on a very urgent basis. For example, we watched Ebola wreak havoc in West Africa, knowing that as a state with a large West African population, an imported case was a distinct possibility. Thankfully, we saw no cases in Minnesota. However, our lab was among the first in the U.S. to develop the capability to test for Ebola. We developed the capability because of a request from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and because we have the expertise to do it. We have come a long way from our origins as a small food and water chemistry lab to a full functioning laboratory responsible for over 150,000 tests each year. We've made amazing progress, but we may start to see limitations in our progress unless we upgrade critical instrumentation, such as our scintillation counter, which is an instrument that measures radiological contamination, that still runs on an MS-DOS computer and is only able to print on dot matrix paper, which, as you all know, is not something that you can go to your local store and easily find. The state's investment of $2.335 million will help ensure that our lab maintains the capability to be a first-line public health laboratory. This funding would purchase approximately 15 instruments, ranging in cost from about $40,000 to over $400,000. Investment in newer, more sensitive, and reliable technologies is needed to maintain and build capacity for critical testing in the areas of foodborne illness outbreaks, where newer technology can process large numbers of samples rapidly so that the source of the outbreak can be identified and contained before more people get sick. In the area of emerging infectious disease, where new equipment is needed for Minnesota to remain a national leader in detecting and preventing the spread of emerging infectious diseases such as Ebola and Zika virus. For rare but treatable disorders in newborns, new analytical methods can reduce false negatives and false positive test results so that rare or hidden disorders in newborns can be identified and treated early, thereby preventing illness, physical disability, and developmental delay or even death. In chemicals, for chemicals of emerging concern, newer instruments are needed to test water and soil for pharmaceutical compounds, hazardous chemicals, and radioactive substances in our environment to ensure interventions that protect public health. We need the investment because the lab primarily serves MDH programs and other state agencies, so we cannot easily pass increased costs onto our customers. We do work for the public good that typically has no private sector customer. Our expertise, when supported by state-of-the-art equipment and facilities, leverages more federal funds to protect the health of Minnesotans from sources, and funds come from sources such as the FBI and the Centers for Disease Control. Our aging equipment uses old software that is no longer supported by the vendor and cannot be upgraded to more current operating systems. Thus, Minit has to maintain old equipment on separate networks and make costly manual upgrades rather than relying on automatic updates. Thank you for considering our request.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of my concerns is, you know, a few weeks ago there was a press story about the failure of the chain of custody relating to drinking water. And, you know, is that a failure of equipment? Is it a failure of storage, or is it a failure of personnel? You know, and if we are going to keep investing into the equipment, and as we get to more emerging concerns, do we keep doing the same thing, or how do we make sure that doesn't happen again?
Mr. Abdler, is that right?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, it's Allwood, Allwood.
Mr. Allwood, Chair, thank you.
And member, that we have discovered through a process of our own internal review that some samples were not being properly handled. We are still working to identify all the reasons behind that, but you know, as soon as we discovered this issue, we've moved quickly to put in place mechanisms to ensure that the mishandling stops immediately.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do those communities where the drinking water was sampled and there was an error, are they being resampled to check for the public health on those sources?
Mr. Allwood.
Mr. Chair and member, we are in fact going to conduct resamples in areas that we determine that there's a high likelihood that samples were mishandled from.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with the new equipment, my understanding in your drinking water screen is that you're have a relatively limited number of compounds that you're looking at, that maybe it's 20 compounds and it's old chemistry, and we've had a lot of new chemistry that's been looked at. I'm specifically talking about agricultural chemicals such as neonicotinoids, that you're unable to look for neonicotinoids in drinking water, you're unable to look for glyphosate. So are you, with this new equipment, will you be able to screen for those?
I believe Mr. Allwood's going to phone a friend. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, I'm Myra Kunis. I'm the Assistant Division Director of the Public Health Laboratory. Mr. Chair, member. So neonicotinoids in particular, those are a contaminant of emerging contaminants is what we call them. And we are working on that to determine if it's in water, but it is an emerging contaminant. There's no regulation for neonicotinoids at this time, but it's part of our research and development.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is specific to the request. So would the new equipment that you're asking for be able to do those type of analyses, or would you have to continue to farm out your research and your testing?
Go ahead.
Chair? Yes. Member, we don't farm those out right now, and actually when testing occurs, it is typically based on a demand from our partners. So when that demand happens, then we work to develop tests, and that is happening right now.
to continue on.
All right, thank you. I believe we have no other questions at this time, so thank you for your presentation, and we'll see you again soon.
Thanks.
Finally, this afternoon, we have the Como Zoo folks are here. I'm sure some of you had a chance to meet some of their animals. I was going to say inmates, but that's not right. When you're ready, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Just looking for the right one.
Oh, very good.
Look at that. Well, thank you. A little technically challenged. For the record, my name is Michelle Furr. I'm the director at Como Park Zoo and Conservatory.
For the record, my name is Allison Youngheim. I'm the senior keeper at Como Park Zoo and Conservatory.
So thank you for having us here. We're here to talk about our asset preservation bonding requests. But for those who are not familiar with Como, we just want to give you a little update of what we've been up to and some of the new facts and figures that are coming out at the end of 2015. Como Park Zoo and Conservatory is the most visited cultural destination in the state of Minnesota, and annually we see over 2 million visitors each year, and they're coming from all over the state of Minnesota. 22% come from greater Minnesota, which if you do the math is over 400,000 people, and for cultural destinations that's more than some have annually altogether. So we have a significant amount of people that are coming from all over the state, and we have 15% coming from out of state who are contributing to the tourist market here in Minnesota. Como Park Zoo and Conservatory is free. We don't charge for admission, we don't charge for parking, and we don't charge for special exhibits. And we have a voluntary donation program when people do come in, and they were suggested $3, but people throw $1, $3, $5 in. And if they can't give, that's okay. We welcome them anyway. And in 2015, we had a record year of $1.5 million that were contributed into that voluntary donation program, which is about 21% of our operating budget. And when you calculate that operating budget with the number of visitors, our cost to operate is only $4.34 per visitor. Compared to other cultural destinations, the range is anywhere between $12 and $52 per visitor. So we are financially stable. We have a great model right now with our earned revenue and our nonprofit partner, which I'll talk about in a few moments. We're also an economic engine. We recently conducted in 2015 an economic impact study, and the results were staggering. We had over $162.7 million of economic impact to the state of Minnesota just by the operation of Como Park Zoo and Conservatory, which equates to almost over 2,000 jobs. This is, you know, people who are coming from all over the state. They are our visitors, they are our staff, and the expenses that we have for operating. I was out on the zoo grounds on Tuesday. It was a beautiful day, and we were busy, and I ran into a family who had come over 2.5 hours just to see zebras. They had a toddler with them. They were on spring break with their two older kids, and when you think about their travels, they probably had to fill up on gas on the way there. They might have stopped for lunch on the way. They visited the zoo and conservatory. They might have seen some other things while they were in town. They had to fill up on gas to get home and probably had dinner. That's all contributing to that economic impact for the state. The other piece of the study that is not in the $162 million is that when we do capital projects, what we did is our last project in 2013, which was $11 million, and that had over $22 million in economic impact. So the amount of money that was invested in that project nearly doubled, and that was another 200 jobs as part of that contribution. Now, as I mentioned, we have a nonprofit partner, Como Friends, and in the last decade, they have been able to raise over $35 million in the private sector. That's in both operational support on an annual basis, as well as contributing to those capital projects. We see over 425,000 students in a variety of different ways. We go to them at their schools. They come to us for a formal program. We're hitting that time of the year when school buses will be lined up to drop off those kids to do a field trip. It's also the touches that we have in shows like Sparky and our added value keeper and gardener talks. And we recently have done the first phase of our transportation and access improvement plan that was a funded project 2 years ago. And it'll make it much easier when that second phase is done, so those 150 school buses on a daily basis from April through early June will be done so that they have a safe and access way to drop off those students. But because Como is over 100 years old, we have definite needs in asset preservation and an aging infrastructure, and the one that we've identified as our next project is seals and sea lions. For some of you who grew up in the Minnesota, you know that Sparky has been an iconic fixture for conservation and an ambassador for over 60 years. He'll be celebrating that this year as part of his season. But where our seals and sea lions live currently, it was a WPA period project that was originally Monkey Island. It was built in the 30s for the monkeys, and the water was the moat so that the animals wouldn't escape. I think I have a picture here. And in the late 70s, it was converted to Seal Island. And this is what it looks like today on a typical day, 9 months out of the year. It does not have all the adequate fixtures that we need to provide a safe environment for the seals and sea lions, as well as the visitors that come to Como. And one of the reasons why this has risen to a top of the list for us for infrastructure improvement is that we know that there are going to be federal requirements that we're going to be changing for the marine mammal standards. Como has always had a long tradition of being a leader in animal care, and so this is a way for us to be proactive with those federal requirements. We also know that without doing this, this will jeopardize the ability for us to continue to have seals and sea lions in Minnesota, as well as our accreditation through the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. In 2015, we were reaccredited. We also received the Quarter Century Award of 25 years of continuous accreditation, which was part of their inaugural accreditation process. But without doing these improvements, that will all be jeopardized. I'm going to pass it over to Allison, who is going to talk a little bit more about the features of seals and sea lions, as well as the need.
So as you can see, the exhibit is empty three-quarters of the year, pretty much. We have to wait until the weather is warm enough that we can fill the pool. We have challenges both with that and with just moving the animals to there. Our animals in the wintertime are housed in our marine mammal building. They're housed in two separate pools, so they're actually not even together, and we have to voluntarily crate them, move them out, get a cherry picker from forestry to put them into the island so that they can safely get in there. And the same thing on the back end of in the fall. They have to be pulled back that way as well. Michelle mentioned that the Sparky Show has been going on for 60 years, and we use that to educate the public. We've really kind of based all of our shows now off of an education standpoint, talking about conservation, talking about recycling, trying to get people to really care about these animals as ambassadors for their wild counterparts. We're a leader in animal care. We've been doing a training program for multiple years, and we have an excellent training program. But Seal Island and the Sparky Amphitheater were not designed with training in mind. So we have a lot of challenges, and we have a lot of ways that we have to work through things so that we can get what we want accomplished with the animals for these behaviors. We want to, with this new exhibit, meet and exceed the federal and industry standards for seals and sea lions. We want them to be here for the future, for the future of our children. So you can see this is a schematic drawing, a detailed illustration of what our idea for seals and sea lions looks like. It's actually going to combine all of our seals and sea lions, and we currently have four, two sea lions and two harbor seals, into one exhibit. Our hopeful capacity is eight seals and sea lions, so we're hoping to be able to bring in more animals, being able to do breeding and help conserve the species. There'll be more opportunities for training, and there'll be more opportunities for people to see the training, but also to get that close up close and personal feel that everyone loves with Como.
So this project will continue the partnership that Como Park Zoo and Conservatory has had with the state, and will improve what Como does best: educating Minnesota children for free, providing a safe, family-friendly environment, and as leader in the management of pinnipeds, or seals and sea lions, and being good stewards of conservation. This new habitat will provide year-round use, salt water, which right now we're doing fresh water, and will really be an asset to continue those 2 million visitors that come from all over the state and use Como as a resource. So that's our presentation. I want to thank you for your time, and we're more than welcome to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. I'd like to start with a question about the salt water. Is there an advantage to the animals to have them have salt water available?
Yes, Mr. Chair. There is an advantage to salt water. They are naturally found in a saltwater habitat. We currently have a small dip bucket that they will put their eyes into. It's better for their eyes and for their skins and coats to be in salt water. They can survive in fresh water, but as the regulations and the standards are changing, it's becoming more and more recommended that they do be in salt water.
And this new facility would be available to them year-round, is that correct?
Yes, Representative, that's correct. It'll be open year-round. They will have indoor access so that on the really cold days that they can come inside if they so choose, but the water will be temperature-regulated so that they can stay out year-round. It'll be a much better visitor opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Hausman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think you have some history of rescue animals as part of the population.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman. Yes, we do have a very strong history with the NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration. I can never remember what that one stands for. But we have three of our four seals and sea lions are rescue animals, and it's something that they would not have been able to survive in the wild. We have a strong partnership with NOAA and with the University of Minnesota, so we are deemed a very valuable place to bring rescued animals.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this presentation. I enjoy seeing the old picture of the Monkey Island, and it kind of shows before and how much better your effort you're doing to treat the animals. And I like the fact that you've kind of kept some of the old cages in that older building, just because in my youth we used to go there and that's where they were, and such a better habitat for them. But what a really an asset you are to the whole state, and it's really been it's a great facility. So. Thank you.
I don't think I heard a question in there, Representative Lilly. We have a question from Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. in case you want to know, Minneapolis North won today, 80-27. Yeah. But my question is really about the operation costs and the visitors come from out of state. I did some quick math, and it's about $1.2 million. That we pay for visitors come from out of state. Have you guys over the past few years looked at even a nominal fee versus making it free? Not that I'm against people from outside Minnesota getting things when they come here as well, but it's just something to think about. Thank you.
Ms. Hoyer?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have looked at and we have increased the voluntary request to the suggested donation because it's continually increasing the amount. When we started in 2005, it was sort of a novel idea. We were collecting donations at the zoo and not at the conservatory, and we were charging, I think, $1 for the conservatory to get in. And it has come up on would we be able to sustain the same level of visitorship. But the city is very committed to providing this experience right now for visitors and for residents to be able to utilize the park. And it really is an opportunity for anyone who can or cannot afford to come to a situation or an establishment like ours. There's only four completely all-free zoos left in the country, and we're proud to be one of those.
Thank you. Are you done, Representative Dean?
Yeah.
Does this also apply to school buses that come to your facility? There's no charge for them either?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do not charge for a school bus to come or unload and do a field trip. We do offer some fee-based programs, so if they want to come up and do an opportunity to spend some time with our professional education staff, we do provide that at a fee. But field trips, when those 150 school buses line up, they're mostly just coming for the experience. You probably will see them once the capital restoration is done coming back over here. We know that a lot of them do mornings with us or mornings with you and then afternoons with us.
So looking at your pie chart here, do you generate some income from food sales, that sort of thing, at the zoo?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that earned revenue source is where that falls. That is commissions off of food or beverage if you were to buy a burger or cheese curds. It's also if you were to have a wedding ceremony or corporate party. It is commissions off of Como Town, the amusement park next door. So those are all of those earned revenues. And we have seen that part of the pie chart increase over the last decade as well, that we know that we need to provide some of these services, and as we increase facilities like Gorilla Forest or Polar Bears or Ordway Gardens, that takes additional resources for operating, and so we have seen that in that earned revenue as an increase for us to be that financially stable that we are today.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a comment. Last year when we had a day that was just absolutely beautiful and we were in between sometimes during session, I put my jeans on and my sneakers and I went to Como for a couple hours. And I guess at that time, so it was probably the earlier part of May, again, it was a beautiful day, and I probably hit there about 2:30, 3 o'clock. I was really surprised at the amount of folks that were there. There were a lot of parents with kids. I mean, it just really was surprising to me. But I think what was most amazing is the fact that you just walk in and go, and everybody was enjoying it. And that was before they even had food services. I think the only thing you could get was ice cream, and they were doing a pretty good business. But I'll tell you what, when you get done and you hit the gift shop, that's where everybody is. It was just absolutely amazing. But what was really fun is I had barely gotten there, and I was starting to swing around, and I'm not going to remember which animal it was, but it was next to the reindeer. There had just been a baby born, and people were talking about it as I was going down the trail, the fact that there was a new baby born. And so it was really kind of fun to be a part of that community and feel like, you know, oh, we're all part of this, and there's a baby. And it was just really cool. A lot of people gathered there, and like I said, I was just incredibly surprised at the amount of folks there on a nice weekday afternoon when, you know, it really wasn't open, in that a lot of the services weren't, food services especially, weren't open. So I love it. Been going there since a long time. And, you know, I really think we forget about what a wonderful treasure we have in that building. And the carousel is there, too. And I love to see that carousel. I mean, I think we all go and, oh, the memories we have of that. And it's just really fun to still be able to see that in this age of always the new technology and the new rides and the new this, and, you know, how long can your hair stand on end. It's nice to see these wonderful things preserved and still available. So thank you very much for what you do.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that I agree with what Representative Tice says, but I take a little offense to the only ice cream. The only part really bothers me.
I see. Well, that's nice to know. Well, I'm pretty sure I saw the original Sparky, so you may have been there a long time ago, but I bet I was there longer ago. Representative Hausman?
Since we're telling the stories, I'll tell you my favorite one of this year. At Como, we have the stud bookkeeper for orangutans, which I think is for all of North America.
International
stud bookkeeper. And so she could tell you all of those in captivity and what the strain is, you know, where they're bred and so forth. Anyway, so we were walking through the zoo with her, and there was a candy wrapper or something on the ground, and she picked it up, and I said, I suppose at a zoo you have to really be careful about that, because you wouldn't want it to blow into any of the cages. And then she told the following story. This is how smart orangutans are. So if a candy wrapper or something like that blows into the orangutan's cage and they find it, they discovered that then she would come, because she wants it, and she would give them a treat in exchange for that candy wrapper. And then the orangutans very quickly figure out, if I tear this candy wrapper up into a lot of little pieces, I'll have one piece after another to trade for a treat. And then they got even more clever. I can actually control, if I don't like that treat, I won't trade for that one. I'll wait till she comes with it. This is how smart orangutans are. This is just my favorite story for the year.
Well, thank you, Representative Hausman. I really wish you hadn't brought that up, because I'm afraid you're teaching some of your colleagues some habits that I'd just as soon they not learn, but the cat's out of the bag, shall we say. I believe that concludes the presentation.
Just an observation. This meeting ended on a lot more interesting note than it started, with infiltration. I'll just put it that way.
Save the best for last, shall we? Yes, thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you, members. Our meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.